Hi everyone and welcome back to Memcast. We're going to be talking about smoking cessation in this week's episode, and I'm joined by Ian Ferris, who is the tobacco dependency team leader at Kingsmill Hospital. We're going to be talking about very brief advice that we can offer to all of our smoking patients and discuss the various medications and support available to help people quit. So hi Ian, thank you for coming to talk to us today.
You're welcome, thanks for having us in.
The reason we're talking about this is that smoking is still a really big problem in the UK, and there's around 7 million people that still smoke. Over half of these people will die from smoking-related diseases. And just to put this into perspective, in the UK in 2020, there were 80,000 deaths due to COVID, but 94,000 deaths related to tobacco. So we know that smoking cessation is important in terms of mortality, and by encouraging someone to stop smoking, you can save a life. But there's so many other reasons we should be encouraging people to give up cigarettes. So would you mind talking to us from your experiences, Ian, what these things might be?
Sure. So in terms of overall health, from our experience, we might see the same patient a few times a month because of their smoking. Smokers in general are around 60 to 80% more likely to be admitted into hospital because of smoking related illnesses. And there's an obvious correlation between smoking and its impact to overall health and hospital admissions. There are some other short-term gains that are kind of overlooked from time to time. One being saving money, which is obviously very prudent at the moment. So a 20-day smoker will be spending around £336 a month. And even those who choose to roll their own tobacco can be spending around £188 a month on supporting that habit. There are also some short-term health benefits that are worth mentioning as well. And the first one being, probably most importantly, is a reduced heart rate. Secondly, when people smoke, they are polluting their blood with carbon monoxide, which replaces the oxygen in the blood. So only after 3 days of stopping smoking, people can report to feel slightly more energy. They've got more oxygen in the blood, which is obviously better for them. There is also a improvement in lung functionality and less shortness of breath. And basically these continue to improve the longer that someone stays quit. There are some other things as well, such as overall complexion can improve, eyes can brighten, and people will often report that friends comment on how much healthier they look once they stop smoking.
Mm-hmm. So we as healthcare professionals should be taking a smoking history when we're admitting patients to hospital or when we're seeing patients in clinic as part of the social history section of our history taking. So I'd encourage people to ask that question regardless of the presenting complaint, as it's going to be an opportunity for us to offer smoking cessation advice or at least start the conversation about tobacco dependency and potentially quitting. So if we do identify that our patients are smoking, what can we do there and then to kind of kick off the process?
So I think the most important thing to stress is don't ask patients to quit smoking for several reasons. The main reason being that when someone is presented in front of you for whatever reason they're there, stopping smoking isn't probably the first thing on the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Psychologically, it is a huge thing to place on someone's feet when they're sat in front of you. Also, something to bear in mind is that this might be the first occasion that they've ever talked to anyone about the smoking. So met with something like, do you want to stop smoking? You're going to get a yes or a no. And what, as you just said, what we're trying to do is open up that conversation. I think what's been missed in the past that now we kind of do a bit more of because of VBA is provide information to patients. We see numerous patients at bedside. When we ask them if they want support, they assume that they're going to be charged for it or that they need to attend a group.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of misinformation out there about how stop smoking services operate. So it's really important that we all have a really good gist of what our community provider is offering. And for those trusts that have in-house services, again, it's really important that we understand what they offer. So initially, I think it's about providing information to patients to let them know that the services are free. Because of COVID and the way that services had to change their approach, most appointments now are telephone. So ease of access is amazing right now. It's really, really simple to get into services. Again, most services will offer 12 weeks of nicotine replacement therapy free of charge. And in quite a lot of cases, that's sent in the post as well. So you don't even have to collect it from a pharmacy. In some cases you do, but I think in the majority, a lot is just sent through the post. So if we ask someone if they smoke and they tell us that they do, then it might be a really good follow-up question to ask them if they've ever spoken to anyone about it before. Let them know that you can arrange a conversation to be had, especially if it's an in-house service, because I think that seems a bit friendlier if they're at the hospital and they're then spoken to someone from the hospital. Also, what you could do is offer a referral. Most smokers will take 5-7 attempts before they actually quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone's never tried before, I think it's really important we just try and get someone to start that journey, you know, and make an attempt irrespective of how that attempt might turn out. But I think information is key. Again, from what we see at bedside, people just aren't aware that the services either exist or that it's completely free of charge.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I come across often is people say, well, where do I go to for that?
Exactly. So it sounds, sometimes it's a bit daunting, especially in areas, you know, such as Mansfield. People don't often look for free healthcare advice for themselves and so have no idea how to access it. Really important that at primary care, secondary care, other community services, health visitors, that we all have this information to hand, because generally speaking, it is just a phone call that someone needs to make to get that support.
Mm-hmm. And so for us here in King's Mill, that's referring to you guys through our ICE system.
Yeah. Yeah. My team act more like a portal for referrals. So we provide support at bedside for inpatients. We don't generally support outpatient clinics directly. Community providers will have a referral portal on their website. So again, it's up to all of us to ensure that whether it's primary care or secondary care or health visitors, that we have that information to hand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you're in the process of giving your patient some VBA, some very brief advice, and they turn around to you and say, no, I'm not in that frame of mind, what sort of approach would you take?
A couple of things, really. I would probably ask about smoking history. Have they ever had any breaks in that smoking history? Have they ever stopped before? If they have, how did they do that? If they've relapsed, why did they relapse? Most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time, relapses are down to a few things, which is alcohol, significant stress, bereavements. So I think once you've got an understanding of that and someone doesn't want to stop smoking at that point, we are never going to convince them. We're not going to change their minds.
Mm-hmm.
But what we can do is plant seeds. If someone's smoking 10 a day, why aren't they smoking 30 a day?
Mm-hmm.
It must be something within that person that kind of stops at 10 and says that's enough. But again, I think it's more about arming that person with information. So when they do decide it is the right time for them to quit, because there are, you know, many wrong times for people to quit as well, I think at that point, rather than wondering what to do about it, they would know how to take positive action.
Okay. And if they are on board with that and they are interested in stopping smoking, we can offer some behavioural support and medications, mm-hmm. and things to help them. What does the behavioural side of that actually entail?
I'll take a really sort of, I suppose it's a bit of a crude example. Most smokers who are smoking between 20 and 30 a day are probably waking up and smoking within the first 5 minutes of waking up. And there will be very few things they're doing before they actually light up.
Mm-hmm.
But they may wake up, put the kettle on, pour a coffee and have a cigarette. So when someone's trying to quit, if they repeat those actions, the head is going to expect a cigarette at the end of them. So part of behavioural therapy will be looking at those routines and changing them. An analogy I've used when I was clinical was, imagine if I take my son to a toy shop and then ask him to leave without buying anything. We've driven to the toy shop, we're at the toy shop. What normally happens at this point is my son would get something. Not going to, so he's going to kick off, and your head will do the same thing. So what we would recommend is that when someone wakes up, they've changed their behaviours completely, because it will distract them for a start, so it will keep them more occupied than sitting around and waiting for the time to pass.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really useful thing to use alongside nicotine replacement therapy, because neither will work on its own. So what we want to try and do is stop the head expecting a cigarette at the end of it. So you could, for example, in the morning wake up and drink some fruit juice. Most smokers of 20 or 30 a day don't eat breakfast. So again, something else we might try and introduce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, changing those routines, deceiving the mind. And then the other aspect of behavioural therapy is staying occupied when you are having a craving, keeping the hands occupied. Smokers are always used to putting their hands to the mouth so the brain can receive nicotine. And in the same way that if you're thirsty and someone's drinking water in front of you, you're probably going to lick your lips because your body is saying, look, we need to do this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Smokers find it really hard to keep their hands occupied. Jigsaw puzzles, reading, computer games, anything like that to keep the hands and mind occupied is really, really useful.
Brilliant. And you mentioned earlier that there's kind of a telephone service. Is that how this behavioural support tends to be offered now? Or is there face-to-face things? Is there apps? Like, what options do patients have?
Yeah, I think there are more options now than there ever have been, really. I'm generalising slightly, but services provide a mix of telephone support and face-to-face. And in terms of which is better, it's horses for courses, really. Some people respond really well to face-to-face intervention. Other people would much prefer not to turn up to clinic to have a discussion with an advisor. There are several apps that you can use. The apps generally will do things like let you know that if you stop smoking for 2 days, nicotine's out of your system. After day three, day four, carbon monoxide is now out of your system. It will also, the NHS one, will calculate how much money you've saved as well.
Mm-hmm.
So again, in terms of short-term gains and keeping that person motivated, apps are really, really useful. In an ideal situation, someone would use all of it. So they would have some face-to-face, they would have a bit of support over the telephone. I personally find giving behavioural therapy face-to-face better. I'm not sure it's always received better that way, but certainly I find it easy to articulate that face-to-face. But it's just as useful over the phone. Like I said, the apps are really, really good. Some apps will go as far as having sort of preset prompts for people if they put little issues they're having in the app. It's kind of like artificial intelligence, but not quite that.
Mm-hmm.
And it will have a preset prompt just to remind someone of what they need to do to maybe distract.
Okay, brilliant. Alongside that behavioural support, we can also offer the pharmacological treatments. What options are available for clients and how do they work?
So at the moment, unfortunately now, there is only one option, and that's nicotine replacement therapy. Previously, we had nicotine replacement therapy and then the pharmaceutical options, which were Champix and Zyban. So I'll touch on the pharmaceutical options that aren't available because they are really useful to know about, and potentially there is a third one coming out at some point. So Champix is a purpose-built drug for smoking cessation. Zyban is a mild antidepressant as a side effect of stopping people smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Champix works by acting as a partial agonist to a beta-2 receptor. The way I used to explain it to clients is that nicotine knocks on the door of the receptor, but the receptor's not listening anymore. So basically what both drugs do is they stop the reward cycle from smoking and then the reuptake of dopamine and noradrenaline and all the really nice stuff in your system. So they stop cigarettes from working. They're no longer available. I must say, though, with that, in terms of behavioural therapy, as we've mentioned, it is really difficult to convince someone to change their behaviours when nothing in their head is telling them they want to smoke anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So Champix especially is a bit of a double-edged sword in that it can be a really effective drug to get someone to quit. But in terms of long-term quits, that would be quite tricky. Quite a lot of people relapse after Champix because they can be a bit blasé and casual about it. So what we have now is nicotine replacement therapy. And there are several forms of nicotine replacement therapy. There's long-acting and short-acting. The only product that's really long-acting is a nicotine patch. A patch is a really good way of having a baseline of nicotine in your system, especially for heavier smokers who may be using more than one product. So, for example, you could use a patch that gives you the baseline for between 16 and 24 hours a day. 24-hour patches are designed not necessarily for someone who might smoke in the night, but for someone who wakes up and immediately smokes. So mm-hmm. It's preloading them with nicotine before they wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So you could use a patch as a baseline, and then for every significant craving you might receive, so first thing in the morning, after meals, getting in from work, before bed, it's quite often useful to use one of the other products. So either gum, lozenges, mouth spray, nasal spray. The good thing about gum and lozenges is it repeats the hand-to-mouth action that someone would have while they were smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Chewing in of itself can decrease anxiety ever so slightly, so it's quite a good thing to do. With the oral products, with chewing gum and lozenges, it's important that once someone has got the taste of them, that they park them because the nicotine is absorbed through the mucosa. So if someone keeps sucking on a lozenge or chewing gum without parking it, what will happen is a lot of that nicotine goes into the stomach and then it will just cause hiccups and perhaps increase flatulence as well, which no one really wants. The sprays, especially the mouth spray right now, is really good. It's a really fast-acting product. That's called Quick Mist. The absorption rate of that is around 30 seconds from spraying to getting nicotine into the system. So that's really, really fast-acting. The spray is really easy to use. Again, it's absorbed by the mucosa. It's very discreet. The nasal spray, for me, in my experience as an advisor, is a real Marmite sort of product. People either use it and quit and love it, or people can't stand to use it. the really good effect of the nasal spray is it provides someone with a really good hit, because it's a nasal spray and it's laced with nicotine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a product that I forgot to mention as well, which is something called the inhalator. The inhalator is a white plastic tube that contains a nicotine cartridge. Some of the time it's slightly misused in that people will draw it back and into their lungs, but the nicotine is not absorbed through the tissue of the lungs. It's absorbed through the mucosa. So perversely, it's almost better to use it like you are smoking a cigar, which is to breathe it into the mouth and not into the lungs, breathe it out again. There have been some developments in terms of pharmaceutical options. There is a new drug available. I believe it has been trademarked in certain areas as Tabex or Tabex. And I think the drug's name is cytosine. And that will work in a very similar way to Tampix, but it's derived from a plant extract. So potentially, for people who are buying it privately for themselves, it would be a lot cheaper. The National Centre for Smoking Cessation Training, or the NCSCT, give us regular updates about that. So we'll just wait for further news of when that might be released onto the market.
Okay, so that's still waiting in the wings at the moment.
Yes, very much so. We're all very excited about that.
Brilliant. Now, you mentioned just a couple of side effects there from the nicotine replacement. Are there any other significant side effects we should be aware of?
Generally speaking, there are regular side effects that people get from using certain products. So, for example, if anyone's very sensitive skin or any skin allergies or is allergic to plasters, patches can irritate the skin. But there are two different brands of patches, so we often find that where one might be irritating them, the other one doesn't. And we always say to clients, if it causes irritation, that's one thing, but if it's outside your comfort threshold, then remove it.
Mm-hmm.
There are also some little bits of anecdotal evidence that we have as to how to get around that. Some people use antihistamines when they're taking patches to stop the irritation. With all the oral products, they can cause mouth ulcers, less so from the mouth spray. But the gum and lozenges certainly can cause mouth ulcers, general discomfort in the gums as well. Some of that is down to the strength of the gum that they may be using. Generally speaking, it comes in two main strengths, which is 2 milligram and 4 milligram. People who use the 4 milligram often report a bit of pain around the gums from using it. That's generally down to the absorption of nicotine into the system. Similarly, when people use patches, they can report a little bit of numbness in their arm. The inhalator, funnily enough, has probably the least side effects of any product, and that's generally because the cartridge is a dry cartridge. There's no vapor, there's no liquid, there's nothing like that. People can report having dry throat from using the inhalator because it is a very dry product anyway. Nasal spray has almost obvious side effects, which is it will cause nasal irritation.
Mm-hmm.
People often sneeze quite a bit when they've used it. And same with the mouth spray. With the pharmaceuticals, what used to happen with Zyban and Champix, the main side effect there would be nausea. Rarely was anyone ever sick, generally because people take their first tablet in the day on an empty stomach, because traditionally smokers don't eat breakfast.
Mm.
So we'd often encourage people to eat, drink plenty of water before then taking the first tablets of the day.
Okay, and so if they have attempted to stop smoking using these medications and haven't been successful on that attempt, what's the protocol, or what do you think about before trialling it again?
First of all, it would depend on why someone has failed to quit or relapsed. So if it's a significant event, then that will depend on how long that significant event might be going on for. Services will also have their own policies in terms of re-engaging people who haven't quit. For a lot of services, it's between 2 and 3 months. For the person who is trying to quit, you could just start these whenever you want, really. There is no cooling off time that you need from using anything like that. As I mentioned before, we don't have the pharmaceutical option, but with the pharmaceutical option, when people were using it, if they were still smoking while they were taking that, we just wouldn't recommend it again, because it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not working, it's not working. It's, you know, behavioural therapy will help a little bit with Zyban and Champix, but really, if they were going to work, they'd have worked already.
Okay. The thing that I wanted to just finish on was asking about vapes and the current guidance around vape use in smoking cessation.
The strap line right now, I believe I've got this right, is they are far safer than smoking, but they're not 100% safe. They haven't really been in mass use for long enough. They were first designed in the first patent was like 1927.
Oh, wow.
Bonkers how old they are. But over the last 10 years, it's where they've been really, really widespread use. And now we've also got the disposable ones, the Elf bars and the Dinner Ladies. They're all very brightly coloured. So again, the jury's out on that. Is that encouraging children to start vaping?
Mm.
So yeah, they are safer than smoking. So if someone is smoking, they would be better off vaping. And I think psychologically, because vaping isn't smoking, it is far enough removed from smoking for it to be considered a step forwards. And I do hope at some point we have some version or some form of a licensed vape that's available on prescription. I suppose the problem with vapes is that they don't smell very much. And when they do, they can smell quite nice.
Mm.
So people aren't confined to just using them outside. People can use them indoors. So the ease of use is really easy with vapes. So people often find they pick them up quite a lot. So even when someone's down to, you know, a 0 milligram e-liquid, still find them psychologically and in terms of routines, they rely on them a lot. So we are starting to get people coming in now saying, look, I'm sick of vaping and I would really like to stop. And sometimes you can treat that with a bit of nicotine replacement therapy, but generally speaking, getting off a vape, you need a tiny bit of nicotine and behavioural therapy.
Because with the vapes, you can get different amounts of nicotine in the vapes
So you can get a high-strength vape like 18 or 21 milligrams. I'm not sure if 21 milligrams is still available, but 18 milligrams is usually for the 20 to 30 a day smoker. And yeah, you can step down to as low as 3 and then 0. But there is a psychological dependence to inhaling the vapor and breathing it out again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that at that point, if someone's not using any nicotine at all, we certainly wouldn't introduce any more nicotine at that point. We would just try and use behavioural therapy and put some rules in place where they need to leave gaps between using it and things like that.
Yeah. No, brilliant. Thank you so much, Ian, for speaking to us. That's been really, really helpful today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
If you haven't had a go at our question over on our Instagram page yet, then check that out at mem.cast. And we'll see you all again next week for Memcast.